Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I are joined by Dr. Gul Dolan, MD, PhD. We're really excited to have Gul on the show today. She's an associate professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and a pioneer and world leader of psychedelics research. Gul earned her MD, PhD at Brown University and MIT, where she carried out seminal work on critical periods, learning and memory, and the pathogenesis of autism. You can learn about her current work at her lab's website, dolenlab.org. That's dolenlab.org. In our discussion today, Gul teaches us about critical learning periods and social reward learning. She clarifies what it really means when we say psychedelics cause neuroplasticity and explains the difference between metaplasticity and hyperplasticity. We talk about the possibility that psychedelics are the so-called master key that can unlock various kinds of critical learning periods and what that means for treating psychiatric, neurodevelopmental, and even motor dysfunction like that found in stroke patients. Gul provides a neuromechanistic explanation for the phenomenology of a psychedelic trip and makes a case for the critical importance of psychotherapy in combination with psychedelic use for people who are doing so seeking healing and behavior change. Lots of gratitude to Gul for coming on the show today. Real quickly, before we get to the interview, if any of you are looking for good training and education pursuant to becoming a psychedelic therapist, check out Numinous's programs. You can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/our-training-selection. If you'd like to support our show, you can do so by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen. You can subscribe to the show and or you can share the show with somebody you think might enjoy today's episode. And now I bring you Dr. Gul Dolan.
Welcome, everyone, to an exciting episode of Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers. Steve and I are thrilled to be here with Dr. Gul Dolan, Associate Professor of Neuroscience at Johns Hopkins and a pioneer in research into some key considerations around psychedelics, especially critical periods. And we'll talk more about that. But Gul, thank you for being here, first of all.
Thank you very much for having me.
Steve and I both heard you speak at the Horizon Psychedelic Conference. It's been a year and a half or so ago, and I've got to admit that was probably the most intriguing and memorable talk of the conference for me.
Oh,
I was taking notes. I snuck a picture of your critical period slide that I've referred to, and I think you've since shared since then. But I'd love to start by just having you introduce yourself to our listeners.
Okay. So I am a neuroscientist by training. I've been doing neuroscience research since I was an undergrad, that was at Duke University. And then I decided afterwards to do a little bit of side work. I worked as an underwater photographer for a shipwreck excavation for a little bit. And then I decided to go back to school and do an MD PhD at Brown University and MIT, where I worked on critical periods and autism. And then I decided not to do a residency. So I have an MD, but I don't see patients. And I just did a postdoc straight away after finishing medical school and graduate school at Stanford University, where I worked in an addiction lab and started off on this road of trying to understand natural rewards like social rewards. And then when I started my own lab, you know, I kind of brought all of those things together, and I started in 2014 at Johns Hopkins, and I've been there ever since.
Very cool. Thank you. And I've just got to ask, does your underwater photography past tie in any way to your MDMA octopus tank experiment?
Yeah, I think, you know, I always kind of imagine myself to be a sort of National Geographic explorer kind of person. And I loved the idea of being out in the field. But, you know, when I was working on this excavation, you know, it became very clear to me that you have to care about the topic as well. And, you know, I just, it turns out I'm not an archaeologist, and, you know, shipbuilding techniques from 1100 years ago just didn't get my juices going the same way that neurons and the brain does. And so I sort of always had this dream of being able to get back to that outdoor, you know, explorer kind of field work thing. But I really couldn't imagine how that would be, because the type of neuroscience research I do is, you know, very lab based and very, you know, requires a sort of clean, sterile environment and lots of super expensive equipment. And so, you know, I kind of, right after I started my lab, I gave an interview with, I think, like the Turkish American Scientist magazine or something. And I just, you know, they were like, well, what are your long-term goals? And I was like, well, someday I want to get back out into the field. And literally, like, 3 months after that, the first octopus genome paper came out, and I was just like, aha, this is it. This is how I'm going to get back into the field, because, you know, brains don't fossilize. And so really the only way to study brain evolution is through these molecular phylogenetic analyses, and having a genome is the first step towards being able to do that. And so that's how I kind of ended up down that rabbit hole of octopuses and evolution in the brain.
That makes sense. And I have a couple burning questions around the octopuses. Did you give them other medicines besides MDMA?
No. I mean, basically, we only had 7 animals, and we had to send them back to the marine biological laboratory after we were done. And so, you know, we were just kind of testing the first idea that we had, and we were already working on MDMA at the time. And, you know, we wanted to test whether or not, you know, there's so much lore around an octopus, right? We were that they're so smart and they're predicting soccer games and whatnot. And so, you know, there was some question as to whether or not we could take some of these assays and tests that we use in mice and, you know, just transfer them over to octopus. And so, you know, it might have been that we put the octopus in the tank in the aquarium, and, you know, it wouldn't run around and search its environment in any measurable way, because it would just kind of sit in the middle, reach one arm over there, reach one arm over there, and then be like, I got it. I don't need to explore, waste energy swimming around. You know, I know what's there, and I don't want to be there, right? And so, like, we just didn't know, like, even the very basic things like that. We also had no idea how we were going to deliver any drugs to these animals, because, you know, giving MDMA, what we did was we just put it in the water, which, you know, would have been sort of the equivalent of like aerosolizing MDMA and hotboxing, you know, for 30 minutes, right? And so we just, you know, all of the things had to be tested. And with 7 animals, there was only so much we could do and get, you know, interpretable results. But we're definitely interested in doing more.
It's too bad, because, you know, it'd be interesting to see if like octopuses on MDMA have an affinity for glow sticks versus, you know, octopuses on cocaine have lots of pressured speech conversations or.
Yeah, well, definitely at the higher doses, the MDMA treated animals looked a little bit like they were on amphetamine. So they definitely had some hypervigilant behaviors that, you know, were reminiscent of what you'd see on very high doses of MDMA or amphetamine in humans and mice. So, you know, but I know that other people are interested in this as well. You know, I think some people have been looking at hallucinogenic psychedelics to kind of test the idea that, well, you know, if you can't necessarily tell when a mouse is hallucinating, but if an octopus is camouflaging to its environment and it's hallucinating that it's, you know, I don't know, in Disneyland or something, you might be able to see that camouflage on its skin. Those experiments haven't been as fruitful as I think people had hoped. And I think part of that is because, you know, the hallucination on a psychedelic is a little bit more complicated than just frankly seeing something that isn't there. You know, it's kind of this interplay between what you know, what you think you know, what your past experiences are, and, you know, what's in your environment that kind of colors that. And so I think we're going to have to get a little bit more sophisticated to try and figure out, you know, those kinds of responses in an octopus.
So they didn't give octopuses DMT and see sacred geometry on their skin.
Right, exactly. We don't know. And frankly, we might have just gotten super lucky, because, you know, we chose MDMA partially because we were at the time working on MDMA. And serotonin is a very old molecule. So there was a reasonable chance that something was going to happen. But, you know, it seems to be the case that across evolution, the things that change a lot are the receptors, but the transporter, at least at the binding pocket for serotonin, looks like it didn't change that much. And so, you know, it might be that some of these other serotonin 2A agonist drugs aren't going to have as profound of an effect because the 2A receptor has changed too much across evolution. So we don't know. That could be the case.
Does MDMA look like, you mentioned the high dose had some hypervigilance. Would you call that like hyperplastic at the higher doses? Like, you know, Steve brought up cocaine. I'm just curious if it's a sweet spot of dose that leads to opening a critical period.
Yeah, I don't know. I think probably, probably not a dose related thing. It, you know, it's not at all clear that people who take MDMA at high doses are the ones that are having any problems with abuse liability, right? I think that hypervigilance has more to do with the sort of anxiety-like behaviors provoked by, you know, all of the amphetamine classes. That it's I think it's unrelated to plasticity. My guess.
So you may still be doing the same thing with critical periods, but you're also bringing, you hit a dose threshold of some adverse effects that might interfere or show up in parallel, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely see an inverted U sort of dose response for reopening critical periods with MDMA. So low doses don't do it, but super high doses don't do it either. And that's what we see clinically. With the patients as well, like low doses just make people a little bit nervous and anxious. High doses also make them very anxious without very much therapeutic benefit. So we think that that's interesting that parallel holds across species.
Yeah, that's cool. And then so a hypothetical question for you is, I heard in an interview you say that you were pretty sure before that experiment that it wasn't going to work, or you had your doubts. Yeah. And I'm wondering, what would life be like if it hadn't have worked? Or like, would you publish that, and where and how would it unfold in your lab? If that's even a fair question.
Yeah, no, I mean, if it hadn't have worked, we would have basically used the experiment as pilot data to show that, you know, we can measure things in an octopus, that we can give drugs. And my prediction before we did the experiment was that it would do something. It just might not look anything like what it does in a mammal, right? Because serotonin is essentially a very old molecule and very old neurotransmitter that has been implicated in like basically every behavior you can think of, right? It's very old. And so, you know, they might have just like fallen asleep. They might have, you know, they might have, you know, gotten super hyper and, you know, sped around the tank a lot. They, you know, we just didn't know what to expect, but and so I was surprised because, you know, octopuses aren't social. And so it wasn't at all clear that they would have a pro-social response to this drug the way that you know, mammals do. And so, you know, I thought some other element would be conserved, but I was surprised that the pro-social element was.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool.
Reed, Gul, maybe we can back up a little bit and define some terms for the uninitiated. Yeah. So what is a social reward learning critical period?
Yeah, so maybe I should back up even a little bit more and just explain what a critical period is. A critical period is a window of time where the brain is extremely sensitive to its environment and able to make long-lasting connections or learn from that environment in a long-lasting way. And critical periods in neuroscience, you know, we've known about them since 1935, Conrad Lorenz described the first critical period. He won the Nobel Prize for it. It's this imprinting behavior in snow geese. And that critical period kind of set neuroscientists off to decades of research in trying to understand what are the neural mechanisms underlying critical periods, what are the different types of critical periods? So there are critical periods for vision, there are critical periods for language, there are critical periods for motor learning, song learning in birds, you know, touch learning in rodents. You know, we've just known about all of these different critical periods, and, you know, two more Nobel Prizes were given for critical periods in the visual system, understanding the mechanisms there. And the reason that this has been such an intense focus for neuroscience is that we've had this intuition that, you know, there are problems that can arise in our development and our lifetime. And if we can correct them, we should be able to cure diseases. But we've been remarkably terrible at curing diseases in the neuroscience space, partially, and our intuition has been because by the time we get around to correcting, say, the hearing impairment or the visual impairment or the genetic biochemical problem in a genetic disease, the relevant critical period has already closed. So even though you've changed the underlying problem, the brain isn't able to adapt anymore because that critical period has closed. And so when I started my lab, one of the first questions we had is there a critical period for social reward learning? And we thought there must be one because of a bunch of human literature, you know, suggesting that there is one. But, you know, in humans, these kinds of studies are very expensive. You can only kind of look at one or two data points at a time. But in humans, we knew, you know, teenagers are much more susceptible to peer pressure, and that, you know, we learn from our social environment, just like we learn language, you know, depending on the language environment, we learn one language instead of another. Similarly, in our culture, we learn a certain set of rules and hierarchies and what's polite, what's impolite, that are sort of culture specific. And that ability to learn from our social environment is exactly what we were trying to test with this social reward learning critical period study that we did back in when I first started my lab. And so, yeah, so what we discovered is just like all other critical periods, there is a window of time when animals, in this case mice, are able to make learned associations between a social environment and a non-social environment, and that social environment is rewarding and you know, able to produce reward-based learning early on, but that by the time the animals reach mature adulthood, they're no longer learning from their social environment in the same way.
Does this relate to what Timothy Leary in his talks in the 60s would call psychological imprinting? I mean, like he would cite these duckling studies about following a basketball around, right? Yeah. Like, and I know his talks had a lot of kind of wild, enthusiastic content in it sometimes, but I'm wondering if you've looked at how he relayed early research and how it applies today.
Honestly, I had never heard that he had talked about it in that way, but it's not at all surprising. I think that there are a lot of clues from the sort of psychonaut space that what we're describing with this critical period reopening is exactly what psychonauts call things like, oh, I felt so open and I felt like, yeah, I was a child again and I was experiencing the world for the first time. I was able to learn from the world. And like what we know from sort of Charles Manson using LSD to imprint, mm-hmm, if you will, the members of his family into his cult, this is exactly what we would predict if you were, you know, using psychedelics to reopen critical periods.
Cool. And just so a note to self, so we can put it in the show notes, it was a talk he gave at Copper Union in 64. And he said, it had an interesting line I wanted to share in it. He said that he described this experiment where newborn ducklings were shown a moving orange basketball instead of a mother duck right at birth. And wherever the basketball was rolled along the floor, they followed. And once the critical period was over, researchers gave the ducklings the opportunity to interact with a live mother duck, but they ignored her and followed the basketball. So he says to the audience, what accidental orange basketballs have you and I been exposed to in early life? And goes on to talk about how psychedelics can help reopen that.
That's interesting. I mean, that's really interesting. I have a feeling he was probably talking about the snow geese instead of ducks, but because that's the most famous example of that imprinting behavior, but it's possible that it's been done in ducks as well, and I'm just not aware of it. But yes, no, that's remarkable that he said that. And actually, I think that's right. I mean, I probably ought to cite him now. I had no idea that he had that idea. Like, you know, because I've been going around, like, to neuroscientists, you know, just to give you a little bit of context, you know, when I was a graduate student at MIT, we were, you know, in a little bit of a hot rivalry debate with another lab at Harvard. And the Harvard lab was really pushing this idea that there are master keys and that we just have to figure out enough of the mechanisms and we can use those master keys to unlock whatever critical period we want. And my intuition at the time was like, that's crazy. Anything that could do that to the brain would either cause amnesia, produce seizures, or, you know, disrupt the structural integrity of the brain, which I called the melty brain problem. And so I just didn't believe that there was such a thing as master keys for reopening critical periods. And so, you know, now that our lab is really, you know, the first to kind of show directly that psychedelics are reopening critical periods, our critical period, and having more and more evidence that they are, in fact, the master keys for unlocking critical periods. I gave a talk at Harvard, you know, not so long ago, and I had to like sort of apologize for my skepticism about that. But, you know, this is what science is all about, right? Like you want to, if you're wrong, you want to be the one that proves that you were wrong.
Yeah. Well, that's a really neat story because I too embrace the skepticism, but it's also fun to admit when your doubts were proven wrong by the studies that unfold. I think that's a neat story.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one cool thing about it is that I think that, you know, we're the next direction that my lab is heading in is trying to understand exactly how it is that psychedelics circumvent this so-called melty brain problem. And the way I think of it is that, you know, one of the impressive features, and Timothy Leary spoke about this as well, about psychedelics is that they are context dependent, right? So he talked about it in terms of set and setting. And, you know, in the clinical literature, we have a sense that, you know, you can't just take MDMA and go to a rave and expect to cure your PTSD. You really want to be in the right clinical context. And when we look at all the different clinical trials using psychedelics, I think the most successful trials have been, you know, MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD. Whereas the trials where people are just sort of using psychedelics as, you know, next generation SSRIs, you know, ketamine clinics, where there's not like a particular emphasis on the psychotherapy, or the psilocybin for depression trials, where the psychotherapy was there in case somebody had a bad trip, but it wasn't really a part of it, right? And so that clinical evidence is supporting this idea that context really matters. And so, to my knowledge, our critical period explanation of how psychedelics are working is the only one that kind of takes into account that context or set and setting dependence of these therapeutic actions and really sets it apart from other mechanistic explanations that, you know, basically, you know, if you're thinking of psychedelics as next generation SSRIs and you're looking at, you know, tail suspension task as like the readout for antidepressive properties, those are not context dependent. So those properties, if they are true and part of the experience, seem to be kind of orthogonal to the part of the therapeutic experience that I personally think is most exciting, which is that, you know, you could give this drug and, you know, be cured for life. And so I think that context dependence is actually how the brain, how psychedelics circumvent the melty brain problem, because it's only sort of reopening critical periods or the critical periods that are in the right context. So if you want to reopen a critical period for, you know, dancing, then take MDMA and go to a rave. If you want to reopen a critical period around your trauma, then you want to do some psychotherapy around the trauma while you're on the psychedelics so that you can reopen that limited set of circuits that relate to that trauma.
Yeah, fascinating. Because I was wondering that you've mentioned that there are critical periods for motor learning, like the visual system, and we're talking about social. And I was wondering, you know, if this master key unlocks them all in parallel, but it sounds like it's master key plus context opening up that critical period.
Yeah.
And maybe you could talk a little bit about what else opens the critical period, because I know before this work, it was isolation as an example. But maybe you could clarify that for us a bit.
Yeah, so that isolation paper has not yet been published, so I don't want to go too much into detail about that, but I'll just mention historically, one of the ways that people have reopened critical periods, not our critical period, but before our critical period, before we discovered it, you know, visual critical periods, auditory critical periods, motor critical periods, was to do deprivation experiments. And those deprivation experiments are also context dependent, right? So in order to open a visual critical period, you have to give visual deprivation. So you put the animals in the dark for like a week, and then 2 weeks sometimes. And then after that dark rearing, you have to give them visual experience. If you don't give them visual experience and you just measure right after the dark rearing, the critical period isn't open. But if you give the visual experience, that context of the visual experience, then you reopen the visual critical period. Similarly, we have some data that's unpublished that is suggesting that, you know, if you give social isolation by itself, it doesn't reopen the social critical period. But if you follow that social isolation with that social context or social reintegration, then you reopen the social critical period. I think it's sort of related also to why it is that it's so much easier to learn Spanish if you go to Guatemala compared to Costa Rica. The idea is if you go to Costa Rica, you get immersed in Spanish, but you don't really have very much English deprivation. Whereas if you go to Guatemala, you're not hearing English, so you're getting the English deprivation, and then you're getting the immersion in Spanish. And so that Spanish context has a better chance of imprinting itself on your language circuits, because that's the critical period that's been reopened by this deprivation of English, right? And so what's cool about that is that, A, it speaks to the similarity across different ways of reopening critical periods and the requirement of context. But also, mechanistically, we're beginning to see that there's some overlap, and we're definitely still on the hunt for those mechanisms that are overlapping between them. But sort of at the higher level, it's interesting that these deprivation techniques people have used in religious practices to get to mystical states, right? So, you know, people have gone and lived in caves for a month, or, you know, go to retreats and silent retreats, or go and live in a monastery. And when they do these deprivation techniques, they have these mystical experiences that share a huge amount of overlap with the mystical experiences people report on psychedelics, which leads me to believe that what it feels like to be in this mystical altered state of consciousness is just what it feels like to reopen critical periods. And it's no accident to me that, you know, what the Zen Buddhists call, you know, what they're trying to get to with these deprivation techniques or these mystical states that they're inducing is beginner's mind. I mean, if you were looking for a neurobiological correlate of beginner's mind, reopening critical periods would be it.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a lot of rich sort of phenomenology that suggests that we're on the right track here.
So cool. And I imagine this is a spectrum and would apply in small ways to when I get in a sensory deprivation tank. Shout out to John Lilly, who invented those. But like if I get in one of those for an hour or two versus sitting in a cave for a month, do you think there's some mechanism of reopening happening after I come out of that?
You know, I don't know. It's below our detection threshold. We definitely have looked at microdosing, for example, and have not seen it. We have looked at different amounts of deprivation to see if we can reopen, and we're just not, like, lower amounts of deprivation don't totally reopen. So I do think that there is some threshold, and I think it has something to do with why critical periods close and why there might be mechanisms around for reopening them. And that is, you know, we have critical periods because there just aren't enough genes to encode every type of behavior we might need to know. There aren't enough genes to encode, you know, the 260 possible types of language we might need to know as a human. And so what's encoded instead is the ability to learn that language, whatever language is appropriate for your environment. But then they close because, you know, mostly we live in stable environments and it's just much more efficient to rely on habits to navigate our world. And it's energetically yeah. costly to constantly be in that beginner's mind and, you know, be here now. You know, it's hard to be here now all the time, right? It's just, mm-hmm. it drains you emotionally. And so they close. But what happens if your environment undergoes like a radical shift, right? So imagine you're a mouse and your whole, you know, social group gets eaten by a wolf, or you're a human and you have to go into lockdown for 2 years because a virus is about to, you know, destroy the population, or, you know, you move to a new country and you have to have a new, you know, nobody speaks the language yeah. that you, and so these radical shifts in your consciousness or these radical shifts in your environment, I think somehow signal to the brain, perhaps through, you know, turning down the signal to noise ratio or something, that is saying, oh God, things have changed and I need to reopen so I can adapt to my radically shifted environment. And so these deprivation techniques, if they're not sufficiently radical enough, I think they can't reopen.
Yeah, that makes sense. Maybe like people's psychedelic experiences, I'm just wondering if it applies to the fact that sometimes, and this is all anecdotal, seems like people's first experience is a big transformative one, but someone who does it every week isn't having the same kind of percentage net change in their life each time.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And I also think that, you know, people who are doing it every week, you know, kind of depending on which one, like if it's ketamine, for example, doing it every week, you might just be keeping it open for a longer amount of time. But I also think that the way that ketamine is delivered for the most part is not meant to be this like big transformative insight, or, you know, it's not paired as much, you know, with these sort of, you know, pre-drug, you know, prep sessions where you're asked to, you know, look at your trauma, look at your history, look at the yeah. way that you relate to your depression. Was there some instigating event? You know, what's in your history that led you down that road to depression? You know, those kinds of things are not usually part of the therapeutic effort. But for something like MDMA, I think the danger is if you keep doing it over and over again is twofold. One, as you say, it might be that, you know, by getting too used to it, you're not having this radical shift in your environment feeling anymore. But more likely, I think what's happening is that, you know, the mechanism has that reopened hasn't come back down to baseline. And so you're just kind of keeping it, you know, open. And eventually, you know, like I think the danger of treating these drugs too cavalierly, too much with like without respect for the very big changes, the very powerful effects that they're having on your brain, is the metaphor that, you know, I'll borrow from Buddhist psychology of, you know, when you're dealing with trauma, you're going to bring up this trauma to your consciousness, and then you have to give it time for that refuse of your trauma to compost and get transformed into, you know, something else like a flower. And if you just keep bringing up, pardon my expression, you know, the refuse or the shit without composting it, soon you're just going to have a room full of shit and no flowers and no opportunity to make flowers because you just haven't given yourself enough time to process, to integrate, to absorb all of that difficult information. And then you could get into this pattern of constantly seeking the sort of relief from suffering that comes along with reopening critical periods without using that period to transform those memories.
I love that analogy, the compost shit and the flower.
Well, it's not mine. I borrowed it from Thich Nhat Hanh, who has this great book called No Mud, No Lotus. And he uses mud because he's, you know, more elegant than I am. But, but yeah, I mean, I love that idea. And I, you know, I read that book. You know, I was telling somebody about our psychedelics research, and she mentioned this book. She had a t-shirt of it, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. And so, yeah, I was actually getting cool. my nails done. She was the nail person. And, yeah. Oh, and, awesome. That's how I heard about it. And I love it. I think it just hits the nail on the head.
Oh, thank you.
I think that, you know, the potential for your research to explain the physiological mechanisms behind what a lot of people who have experienced psychedelics phenomenologically will describe is really, really fascinating. And sometimes you see sort of pedestrian explanations using buzzwords from research that probably overextend. Like you'll hear a lot of times people talking about, oh, psychedelics works because of neuroplasticity. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if there's anything you'd like to clarify or explain or correct. You're so articulate. You do a great job of distilling what's really, really esoteric and complicated into everyday language. Maybe talk a bit about what is meant by neuroplasticity, maybe the difference between hyperplasticity and metaplasticity. What does neurogenesis really mean? What can we actually say about what these compounds are doing in the brain?
Right. So great. I'm so glad you asked that, because this is very frustrating to me as a neuroscientist. It's not just lay people who do this, you know, the chemists are doing it too, and they just drive me nuts. Because, you know, it's 30 years of neuroscience research that they've just not aware of. But basically the idea is that, you know, plasticity is being treated as if all plasticity is good plasticity. And that's just not the case. And we know that it's similar to, you know, not all growth is good growth. You know, when you're developing, when you're getting, you know, when you're a baby turning into an adult, that growth is good, but it follows certain rules and certain patterns. And it's not, you know, you're not growing everywhere all at once with the same speed. And if you do, then it's called cancer, right? So like, we know that, you know, out of control growth that breaks all the rules is really bad and causes, you know, diseases. And similarly, plasticity, you know, when you're young and your brain is still developing, the rules around plasticity are a little bit more relaxed. There's a lot more of it happening. But as you get older, that plasticity is curtailed, that there are sort of limits put on that plasticity by the sort of molecular structure of the neurons themselves as they get older, by all kinds of other elements that are in the circuit that each of these neurons are embedded in, like modulatory elements like dopamine and serotonin and norepinephrine, or inhibitory connections like, you know, GABAergic neurons that are imposing, like restricting the amount of plasticity. And then sort of the last step is the structural components like morphological changes and extracellular matrix that really, you know, as the brain matures, constrain plasticity. And that change over development in the amount of plasticity that you can induce, or how easy it is to induce plasticity, is called metaplasticity. And that's just normal sort of developmental changes, right? So the problem comes from a lot of studies have tried to get down to like a quick and dirty assay for how to measure the effect of psychedelics. And they have used tissue culture dishes to measure what psychedelics are doing in a dish. Unfortunately, those tissue culture dishes are essentially like baby neurons sitting by themselves without any of those inhibitory connections or any of that relevant extracellular matrix. And so, you know, what neuroscientists have known for the last 20 years or so is that you can spit on a culture dish and get plasticity, right? Like it's just a technical artifact of the fact that these culture dishes are stripped of a lot of these mechanisms that normally constrain plasticity. Yeah. And so there have been a few handful of reports about, oh, you know, psychedelics are, and there's a, you know, debate right now, is it, you know, is psychedelic induced plasticity in a dish because of 2A or BDNF? And I actually think It's neither one. It's an artifact. Neither one of those stories, I think, really holds a lot of water. And I'm relieved that they don't, because if it was true that psychedelics are inducing this kind of hyperplasticity, which is what's being reported in these culture dishes, then you would expect psychedelic drugs to be very addictive. Because what we know is that drugs of abuse like heroin, cocaine, amphetamine, alcohol, nicotine, these drugs are, you know, defined almost by the fact that they are able to induce bidirectional hyperplasticity in adults, right? And so psychedelics, we don't see any evidence that they do that. My lab has looked. We have not been able to reproduce any of those in a dish kind of responses. And the people who have found plasticity changes in adulthood in vivo, what they're reporting is very sparse, so less than 5% of the spines, dendritic spines, are changing, and context dependent. So it's only the spines that have recently been activated that are changing. That's much more consistent with sort of a metaplastic mechanism rather than this over hyperplastic mechanism that people are reporting from cultured neurons.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And so in your paper, your recent one on the psychedelics reopening the social reward period, you gave these different drugs to mice, right? MDMA, ketamine, ibogaine, psilocybin. And I saw in some of the MDMA work, maybe the previous work, that oxytocin had a role as part of this key. Wondering, is the mechanism drastically different for each, or is it the same overall kind of combination of a bunch of common factors that open it up at these different durations?
Yeah. So basically, when we first did the MDMA study, the Nature paper from 2019, our working model at that time was, this is only going to work for MDMA because MDMA has this weird ability to like massively induce oxytocin release. And that's why it's pro-social. And because of this massive pro-social effect, it's going to be able to reopen a social critical period. And so we were like floored when LSD, psilocybin, ibogaine, and ketamine all did the same thing, right? So they all reopened, and they all reopened, you know, using sort of a bringing back oxytocin LTD, metaplasticity of oxytocin plasticity mechanism. But I think that the oxytocin social story now is a little bit of a red herring. I think that oxytocin metaplasticity is happening, but it's happening because we happen to be trying to reopen a social critical period. When we move on and try and reopen like a motor critical period, we think neither oxytocin metaplasticity nor the social context will matter at all. And so it's a little bit, the oxytocin social story is a little bit of a red herring. And the reason we think that is a couple of things. One is that there's other mechanisms that are shared. So this extracellular matrix mechanism for closing critical period seems to be, you know, undone by the psychedelics. And that is also what that extracellular matrix mechanism is also what people have implicated in the visual cortex, for example, and in the motor cortex as one of the mechanisms that allow for reopening. And so the mechanistic thing, but then the other thing which you sort of mentioned is that there is this proportionality between the duration of the acute subjective effects of these psychedelics in humans and the duration of the critical period that gets open. So independent of whether, you know, nobody's doing a cuddle puddle on LSD, right? Like most people just are, you know, staring at a chair or their finger or you know, whatever it is. They're not, it's not an acutely pro-social effect, but the proportionality between the duration of the effects and the duration of the critical period open state really suggests that, that what it feels like to be in the altered state of consciousness that's common across psychedelics, whether they're pro-social or not, is what it feels like to reopen critical periods.
And this was a mouse study. And, you know, I know we all have the question of how generalizable is it to us? And What do you think on this topic in particular? Do you think it would hold up in humans and that same proportionality, et cetera?
Well, it's a little bit tricky because, you know, converting mouse time to human time, you know, we have a rough estimate of what we can do, but those estimates change when at different times of development, right? So like, you know, mouse time to human time might be like 7 years at, you know, very early development, but 10 years at later in development. We just don't, it's hard to change it across development. And when you're bringing back development, you know, we, it's going to be especially tricky. So the way I couch it is that I think that if I, my best guess is that MDMA reopens the critical period in a mouse for 2 weeks, but then it's closed at 3 weeks. And I think that the best rule of thumb estimate would be that in a human, it would be at least 2 months. I mean, sorry, at least 2 weeks after MDMA, the critical period would stay open, but it might be as long as 2 months to a year, right? So it's at least that minimum amount because time is expanded. But yeah, and so I think that it will translate. The problem is, of course, how do we measure critical period reopening in a human? And, you know, it turns out that this assay that I'm describing for how to measure social reward learning in mice, there's a human version of it. It is doable to do this experiment in a human, but it would be crazy expensive to do that experiment. And so, you know, I think for the time being, we're going to have to rely on the mouse studies to guide us towards these mechanisms.
So, you know, thinking about that and looking at the chart that Reed mentioned that he snapped a picture from during our Horizons, it's such a great looking chart that just shows what you're describing, the acute subjective effects of each of these medicines, how long they last, and then, you know, what you've noticed in the mouse studies for critical period reopening. I'm just thinking of the clinicians in the audience that would want to make clinical decisions based on data. And it's certainly, you don't want to make a lot of clinical decisions based on preliminary data or, you know, rodent models versus human models. But I can imagine somebody looking at your chart and being like, oh, you know, the critical period in mice for ketamine is 48 hours. So I guess we better make sure we do all the therapy we can in the 2 days following a ketamine experience.
Yeah.
Is that a bridge too far, or should we wait to make decisions like that? What can we say as clinicians based on some of these data?
I mean, I think it's a reasonable guide because of that proportionality, right? It's not like, you know, I think before this study, there was a lot of question like, how much can we relate the head twitch assay or the backwards walking assay or the tail suspension task to what humans are experiencing? But this proportionality between effects in humans and effects in mice in terms of, you know, what is happening in response to these psychedelics is a pretty good clue that, you know, we can relate back and forth between mammals and humans. And if, you know, it was my clinical practice, I would definitely be, you know, being conservative about how I was approaching my patients and taking it, you know, taking the conservative approach means we're giving these drugs, the acute effects are lasting 5 to 6 hours, but we know from mouse studies that this window is open for 2 weeks afterwards. We probably need to treat that 2 weeks after we've given the MDMA or the, you know, 4 days after we've given the ketamine as a sort of sensitive time for our patients where they're going to be much more susceptible to outside influence, where they're going to be vulnerable the way that a child would be vulnerable. It's the best window for the therapeutic opportunity, but it's also something that we need to be especially careful about, you know, reintroducing our patients to trauma during that time. You know, I heard someone describe their experience on the clinical trials for MDMA, where the trial design had not included, you know, treating this 2 weeks after the acute effects have worn off as this sort of especially sensitive, vulnerable time. And the patients described it as, you know, I was on the, it was like I had been, had a heart surgery and they had put in the valve and then left me on the table with my chest wide open, right? Like that kind of prolonged period of vulnerability, of sensitivity, I think is an apt metaphor for what you would expect, you know, based on our mouse studies, that you need to be careful about when you're thinking about how to implement these drugs clinically.
Yeah, I love that when this happens, when our kind of anecdotal experience learned in the real world, especially from the indigenous populations who've been working with medicines for so much time, when that advice we land on without science to back it converges with like what's coming out of the lab. It's just, it's a neat thing to see unfold.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's, I'm so glad you brought that up because, you know, I do think that especially, you know, a few years ago, there was this, I don't know, feeling going around in the psychedelic space, like, well, you know, we have everything we need from the indigenous cultures. They've taught us how to use these. We have this whole, you know, 30 years of underground work. We don't really have to understand the mechanisms because they work, and we know they work, and we have thousands of years of experience behind us. And I was horrified by this as somebody who studies mm-hmm. mechanism, that like the hubris of that kind of argument, because, you know, when we go into, let's say we take Ibogaine from Africa and we say, oh, well, it's just the medicine. It's the, all we have to do is extract the elements, discover the receptor, and then we'll be done. We'll understand what we need to know. And then we're off to the races and can make a bunch of new molecules and patent them and, you know, insert them into the medical model that we already have. What's missing there is a bunch of stuff that, you know, we may be disregarded as, you know, just hocus pocus or ritual that is irrelevant to the therapeutic efficacy. But meanwhile, for example, our studies show that if you give MDMA in social isolation, it doesn't reopen the social critical period. You have to give MDMA in a social context. Well, what is some of the context of the way that Ibogaine is delivered, you know, in the indigenous community? Yeah. They are, you know, doing face painting. They're touching each other. The whole community is involved. It's very much, you know, holding each other, you know, being, you know, in these tents together. You know, it's just a very social in context that the Ibogaine is being delivered in. And that turns out matters, right? And so we would never understand that if we hadn't taken the time to look for the mechanism and understand what things matter for how these drugs are working.
Yeah, I love that. And so question on the ketamine one, because I saw in your paper that when you increase the LSD dose, it didn't extend the critical period. With ketamine, you know, you have this acute effects range of 30 minutes to 2 hours, which encompasses most clinic ketamine work. But sometimes people give ketamine in a long IV, like the first eating disorder study of ketamine gave 10-hour dosing sessions, mm-hmm. IV drip for 10 hours. Would you expect that to extend the critical period, just theoretically?
Yeah, I mean, if I just had to guess, yes, I think that the difference between that experiment, so we also looked at very high dose ketamine, so anesthetic dose ketamine, and it did not mm-hmm. reopen. And that jives well with the clinical literature. It's not like people are going into surgery, having like a ketamine anesthesia, and then waking up cured of depression, right? It's that there's just not a clinical literature around that. And we think the reason for that is because, you know, when you are anesthetized, you are not having a social context. You're just anesthetized, right? Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like taking it in isolation. We're working on another paper that is, you know, systematically quantifying this context dependence across different psychedelics. But in the case of high dose ketamine, we think it's or anesthetic dose ketamine, it's just not allowing for the right context. Now, that being said, there is a paper or two papers actually that have shown that if you give back-to-back ketamine, like once every, I think 6 or 7 hours for six mm-hmm. times in a row, then that administration of ketamine is able to reopen the ocular dominance visual critical period. And the idea there is that by doing six times back-to-back ketamine, you're sort of mimicking an LSD effect because it's the, over this prolonged period, and you would expect that because the duration is longer, it's able to keep the critical period open longer. As for the LSD, the reason that we did that experiment is because, you know, some people are really excited about DMT as like, oh, you're just going to be thrown out of the plane and you're going to have this massive experience, but it lasts such a short time. It's more clinically applicable because, you know, it's intense, yeah, but short. And our intuition is that, no, that DMT ought to look just like ketamine. It's the duration is short. It doesn't matter how intense the experience is. The duration is so short that it's not going to keep the critical period open longer. And so we did the LSD experiment because the prediction was that at 50 times the dose that we need to normally to reopen the critical period, that that would be a very intense experience. And what we showed is that it didn't keep the critical period open longer than a less intense, you know, regular dose of LSD.
Yeah, it makes me wonder about the difference between, you know, injected or vaporized, you know, DMT versus something like ayahuasca, right? Where the experience is much longer. It's more similar to an LSD experience, yeah, and whether that would have...
I mean, that's a great question. And we do, I mean, I do eventually want to get around to that. My prediction is that exactly that ayahuasca type experience would be similar in duration to of the open state to LSD. The reason we haven't done that experiment is sort of a dumb technical thing, which is that, you know, mice don't throw up. And so we get a little bit worried that they're just going to have this horrible trip because, you know, people on ayahuasca often have to throw up. And so, you know, we just, and then also, you know, just technically it's, we'd have to set up the lab to be able to deliver drugs via vapor. And so that's why also we haven't done anything with salvia, which is interesting for exactly the converse reason. It's sort of like ibogaine, but short acting. But, you know, the delivery method is inhalation. So, you know, we just haven't gone. But there's plenty of parameter space to play around here to really prove our point about the relationship between duration, intensity, and critical period open state.
So, you know, you mentioned the challenges that limit a researcher's ability to do what they want to do. One being sort of money, right? So a lot of time research is really, really expensive. Sometimes ethics, right? Sometimes we'd like to do studies on people, but would never dare because our ethics prevent us, right? We don't want to harm people, of course. I'm curious, if the gloves were off, what kind of research would you like to do? Like, what's your fantasy study right now?
Well, I have to tell you, I have two sort of fantasy studies that I'm doing, I'm scraping together to make it happen, right? And so the two are, right now we are raising, it's going to cost us, you know, probably about $1 million to do the first phase one safety trial of psychedelics for stroke. So that is one thing that I am really, really excited about because, you know, if we're right about this master key idea, then a really pressing, you know, area that we need some help in is motor learning after stroke. And there's a critical period for that. And if we can reopen them with psychedelics and then pair that reopening with, you know, the right physical therapy in this case, so the context would be motor again in this case, then we think that we could, you know, help roughly 400,000 patients a year in the United States alone, right? That's a big, big deal. If we can get that done, you know, it would be wonderful. And so we are raising money for that. And if any of your listeners knows a donor or wants to donate, that would be wonderful. We have a Fathom project, which is psychedelic healing adjunct therapy harnessing open malleability. I know it's a mouthful, but clinicians love their acronyms, and so
that's
it's
a great
Fathom
acronym,
with a PH. And that's where they can donate for that trial. And then the other major area that I'm excited about is octopuses, because, you know, like the octopus MDMA study gets a lot of sort of haha, isn't that clever, isn't that cute, isn't that weird, why would anybody really do that kind of response. It's a gee whiz kind of response. But, you know, for neuroscientists, it's a big deal because it challenges some of our preconceived notions about what we learn from experiments where, you know, we give psychedelics, we point to a brain image and we say, aha, default mode network or amygdala or nucleus accumbens. That's what changed. And now we understand how these drugs work. And the octopus research really challenges that whole worldview, because an octopus brain does not have any of those brain regions, and yet they're responding similarly. And so we are in the process of sequencing, well, we finished sequencing this genome of this new octopus species, and, you know, understanding the neurobiology of this animal is going to have all kinds of applications for, you know, why we have critical periods, why they close. You know, maybe an octopus doesn't have a critical period for motor learning, for example, because its arms, when they cut them off or eject them for various reasons, grow back. So maybe you don't want to have a critical period in an animal that can regenerate its arms whenever it wants, right? Mm-hmm. All kinds of interesting questions, from robotics to tissue bioengineering, you know, and if I had infinite money, I would, and time, and, you know, a massive lab, we'd be like all octopus all the time.
Yeah. Well, let me know when you discover that octopuses are extraterrestrials.
Well, I can tell you that looking at this genome, we've definitely had some moments where like, oh my God, this is wrong. Like, this can't possibly exist. Every rule of biology says this animal should not exist on this planet. And they just keep surprising us. So it is a little bit like studying an alien intelligence living right here on Earth.
Yeah, I think they crash landed. So you mentioned stroke victims. I'm wondering about implications for neurodegenerative disease, you know, Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, dementia. Any promise there?
Honestly, I think probably not. I'm not, you know, mechanistically, I'm not convinced that what's going on in Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's disease could be reversed by reopening a critical period. Yeah. There have been some reports that psychedelics have sort of anti-inflammatory properties that might be separate from this context-dependent learning and memory stuff. In that case, you know, I can imagine some, you know, possible promise for Alzheimer's, possibly Parkinson's. But I honestly, it's not where I have a lot of hope, because just mechanistically, there's not a lot of overlap in the way that those diseases progress and this idea of reopening critical periods.
I had the same question around neurodevelopmental conditions of childhood. Like, how do you envision a potential future application for something like, say, autism or Fragile X syndrome, given that the neurodevelopmental damage has been done, some of it anatomically, presumably irreversible? Wondering, like, how might we apply this to helping kids with those kind of conditions?
Yeah, so, you know, Reed, I think you mentioned that you had heard of some of the work I had done as a graduate student around Fragile X and the mGluR theory of Fragile X. And that was, you know, some work that got a lot of people excited. And there was a huge clinical trial to look at, you know, negative allosteric modulators of mGluR for Fragile X and autism.
I was the site on that trial, actually.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. So that was my PhD. So, you know, the preclinical data was all great. It was like 26 labs reproduced my PhD work, and all the drug companies were super excited and we're going to do it. And then the human trials failed. And I think a lot of people's response to that failure was, well, of course it failed. Mice aren't humans. We should have never jumped the gun and gone straight to humans based solely on mouse work. But there were other major differences between the preclinical studies and the clinical trials. And the one that sticks out for me the most is that all of the preclinical studies in mice were done in very early development, right? The intervention was done either right at genesis or, you know, very early in development before the relevant critical period would have been closed. Whereas in the human trials, they were done in, you know, young adults or full-on adults, and the relevant critical periods would have been closed. So my dream experiment there would be to go back, you know, correct the biochemical imbalance by, you know, giving the negative allosteric modulator of mGluRs, and then pair that with psychedelics to reopen the social critical period, and then sort of social psychotherapy, if you will, you know, or social therapy to restore those functions. Now, That being said, one of the other components of my PhD work was to show that there is some evidence that one of the phenotypes in Fragile X is that those critical periods don't close properly. And so you want to be careful about reopening critical periods in a patient group whose disease might be caused by failure to close critical periods properly, right? And so we would want to do that, test that idea first in animal models, going back to the ethics question. We definitely want to make sure it's safe, you know, in these genetic models of autism before we just jump the gun and go straight into people with autism. So that would be my clinical intuition, cool, would be to proceed with caution in those, especially autism and schizophrenia. Yeah.
Well, that makes sense. Well, cool.
Yeah, I'm also curious about, you mentioned that, you know, there are other types of critical periods, not just social reward learning. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned sort of visual impairment and motor issues. I think I heard you on an interview say there's potential for allergies for treating, like, mm-hmm, I'm thinking my kids have like tree nut allergies. Could I give them mushrooms and then all of a sudden they're not going to die when they eat a peanut butter sandwich?
Yeah, I have to say, just a caveat, my mother is an immunologist and she hates this idea, but I'm going to go ahead and tell you anyway. we sparred over it and she's like, that's crazy. That's not true. You know, Voda. But I take a very brain centric idea of, you know, how the body is run. And I sort of, the way that I'm thinking about the allergy idea is that, you know, one of the dominant ideas about why allergy happens is that part of our immune system that is meant to fight off parasitic infections, you know, in the modern age where we're, you know, eating clean food and drinking clean water, that part of our immune system is just left jobless. And so it goes on the hunt for some other something in the environment to attack. And the threat that gets assigned is probably the job of the brain. And so if, you know, you have too much processed food in your diet and you're eating those peanuts all the time, maybe your brain says, that's gross, that's bad for you. That's the thing that this parasite needs, that this part of the immune system that would normally be attacking parasite, go after those peanuts. There's just too much of them in this baby's diet. And then you develop an allergy. That would be the sort of pathogenesis that, you know, if we're right about this critical period and there being a critical period for assigning threat that could be relearned by this mechanism. But again, you know, I have terrible horse allergies and it's not like I'm taking a bunch of magic mushrooms and snuggling up to a horse without an EpiPen by my side. Like, it's just right. A theory. I don't know. And we're not an immunology lab, so we're not really set up to test this idea. But if anybody out there decides to test it and they get, you know, results one way or the other, I would love to know about it because I also would like to cure myself of horse allergies.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice?
You know, my oldest son, when he was, you know, 1 or 2 years old, had peanut butter that caused his whole face to swell up in hives. It hadn't happened previously, but then it never happened again. We thought we were in for a long road of peanut allergy, but then there was an accidental exposure within months and nothing happened. And I've always been searching for an explanation for that, too. There were no psychedelics involved when he was 2 or 3.
Yeah. I don't know. And it is, part of what sort of, I think is sort of supportive of this view of allergies is that a lot of the people outgrow their allergies. They just, as they get older, they outgrow them. And so that's not always the case. Sometimes they get sensitized and it gets worse over time, but you know, it's definitely worth exploring. I just, you know, mm-hmm. I love it. I love it partially because it makes my mom so angry.
Oh, yeah. And then could you, I think I've heard, I don't know if it was an interview of yours or someone talking about it on Wired, but talking about how reopening a critical period for motor learning might help you learn Kung Fu or something like that. can you test these things?
That's what they were doing. That's what they were doing in The Matrix, right?
Yeah. I think that The Matrix is actually, this is the second time somebody's brought up The Matrix, but yeah, I think it's interesting in The Matrix, they take the pill then they like discover all this stuff about, you know, what the reality is. But at some point in the show there, I don't remember, I haven't seen it in a long time, but I saw it a bunch of times when it first came out. They load these programs and then they actually have to practice Kung Fu, right? And so I think it would be similar. You know, if you want to take psychedelics to learn Kung Fu, you can't just take psychedelics and sit in your chair and expect to learn Kung Fu. You actually have to teach your motor circuits, your muscles, your brain, your spinal cord, the practice of doing it. Just like, I don't think you can take a pill and expect to learn Japanese, but you could take the pill, you know, move to Japan, and I think possibly you would have a better shot at learning Japanese if you were, you know, in that environment.
Would it be just to understand the context part of the equation? What would you need to do in the Kung Fu example to really open the critical period in the first place? Would you have to, like, what kind of context do you think would open the motor period?
Well, so I think probably you would want to have taken a few lessons for Kung Fu, you know, or let's use the Karate Kid example, you know, that crane thing he does. You want to have practiced it a couple of times, failed, know kind of the parameter space that your body's trying to explore. The day of the psychedelic, you know, you want to be in a sort of play mode. I think this is really, now we're really out there in terms of what we know and don't know, but like, I think there must be a critical period for what neuroscientists call the explore versus exploit trade-off. And it's this thing that we know that, you know, children learn by exploring, whereas adults are much more like trying to maximize rewards or, you know, maximize efficiency. And, you know, there must be a critical period where that switch happens, where you're like, the play is much easier. And, you know, the anecdote that I like to describe that is that, you know, it's said that when a child is learning how to walk, it actually walks sort of the equivalent of 7 football fields in an hour. And they're able to do that. And if you've ever watched a kid like learn how to pick up some motor task, they're totally undeterred by their failures. You know, like my friend's son was trying to learn how to blow bubbles, and I must have watched him dip the bubbler thing into the bucket at least 100 times. And every time he would fail and go, almost. He did it like 100 times in a row without being deterred at all by the lack of reward at the end of that thing. And that sort of play and just enjoying the doing is, I think, an essential part of what's happening during psychedelics. And honestly, the only time I've ever seen an adult kind of do that walking in, you know, 7 football fields in an hour type of motor is on MDMA at a rave. You know, those people can dance like fools for 8 hours and they feel like 30 minutes went by and they're just not caring that they don't look good when they're dancing or that they're not doing the moves right. You know, they're just enjoying the feeling of doing it, right? And I think that's a huge part of how we would want to design a Kung Fu trial, is to make sure that during the psychedelic experience, they're having an element of play. And then after the experience is finished, I think, you know, 2 weeks of continued, you know, training during that open state is what I imagine.
We got the Kung Fu protocol.
Yeah. I think if you were to go to Burning Man, you'd see a lot of adult equivalents of that kid dipping the the bubble into the bucket over and over and over again.
Yes, I'm sure I would.
You know, there's this, I read this essay that Andy Weil wrote about when he was in college, you know, back, this is in the 60s, people taking LSD for the first time, and he was trying to figure out yoga and wasn't very flexible. He would try to do this plow pose, feet over his head, touch the ground, off the drug, couldn't do it. On the drug, he could do it. Next day, he couldn't do it. But then he'd do it on the drug, and then eventually he figured it out pretty quickly. And this kind of gives me a little bit of mechanistic food for thought on that story I've always liked.
Yeah. Well, and Andy also has a story about allergies that I think is explained by this critical period thing. Paul Stamets has a story about, you know, curing his stutter from, you know, with mushrooms. And I think all of these anecdotes really, you know, our explanation about critical period reopening really do provides an explanation. You know, we don't know, but that I think it suggests that that's how it's happening.
I just was saying, as we start to wind down here, I wanted to say that your work has been so inspiring and actually practically impactful. We have a number of clinics, and we'll probably see across our group 80 to 100,000 mental health visits this year. And I could say it's been impacted by your work and these ideas already, and how we work with ketamine and how we set up research studies. So I just wanted to say thank you for that. And thank you for being here and sharing with us.
Oh, and thank you for sharing that. I didn't actually realize that. And, you know, as somebody who is in the lab and, you know, in a very small environment, it's nice to hear that there are reverberations for what we're doing. That really makes it easier to get through the next round of rejections for our grant applications to know that it's having an impact.
Well, I think it's one of the things that drew Reed and myself to your research is the potential clinical applications. We're both clinicians, you know, and it's more than just gee whiz research. You know, it's more than just explaining what we already know is happening either, right? I mean, it does those things, but it's more than that. There's lots of clinical implications for improving psychedelic assisted therapy and treatment. So good on you, Ghoul. Where would you like people to go to learn more about your research or the Fathom Project?
So everything that I've talked about today can be found on my lab's website, which is www.dolenlab.org. The Fathom Project links are there. The Octopus Project links are there. And just general sort of what we've been up to is all on there.
Awesome. Thank you so much for giving us some of your precious time.
Thanks for doing this.
All right.
Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel, like the videos, and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.